You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, studies show women are interrupted more often than men. In general, we'll find out about new research that asks, do women in high positions of power still get interrupted more or less often?
First, President Trump was clear about where his foreign policy priorities lie when he said this in his inauguration speech.
We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
The president's focus was on jobs for Americans and maybe the trade agreements and immigration patterns could get in their way. Throughout his campaign, analysts described Trump supporters as people not so worried about international policy, people that got the short end of the stick when it came to globalization.
But after speaking against getting involved in certain foreign trade and defense issues, Trump's policy seems to have taken a turn. He said he didn't believe in intervening in Syria, but almost 2 weeks ago, he authorized missile strikes there.
Our next guest says that Donald Trump isn't the first president to break from isolationist campaign rhetoric. It's been done by presidents from both sides of the aisle before. Julia Azari joins us now. She's an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Her research focuses on the American presidency, political parties, and political rhetoric. Julia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, paint us a little before and after Donald Trump the candidate and Donald Trump the president when it comes to interventionism in foreign affairs versus more isolationist tone.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's one of the challenges of describing this is to put these broad labels like isolation or intervention. So I want to talk a little bit about the justification. During the campaign, I mean, it was a very long campaign. We heard a lot of different things from the different candidates. And one of the things that was kind of a continual bit of rhetoric from Trump was his criticism of Obama for over-involvement, actually for previous presidents, for over-involvement in the Middle East. And that was part of his case for how America will come first. We won't spend money on other countries' conflicts. We'll turn inward. And then, what's really interesting about the justification for the airstrike a couple of weeks ago now in Syria was this kind of description of humanitarian impulses, right? So President Trump's stated reason for that was that he was upset hearing about the impact that the gas attack had on Syrian citizens, and he talked about children, and I think this actually really captures what often happens with presidents. In part, is there's this kind of pressure when there's a humanitarian crisis to do something, and so in that sense, although Trump is a very unique president in many ways, this is kind of a typical story.
Right. Talk about some presidents in the past who have come in on the message of, hey, we need to withdraw. We need not be so committed in the Middle East and elsewhere. And then in practice did something different.
Yeah. So the list is quite long and it spans a lot of different kinds of conflicts. I think, as I said in the piece I had in 538, the maybe starkest example of this is Woodrow Wilson running in 1916 on the slogan, he kept us out of the war, and then getting in the war. Both Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon did this to a degree. Lyndon Johnson ran in 1964 on kind of a peace message. He claimed that his opponent, Barry Goldwater, was a warmonger, and then Johnson, of course, escalated the situation and U.S. involvement in Vietnam by a significant degree, to the chagrin of many people who had voted for him. And then in 1968, when he was running, Nixon promised to take rapid action to honorably end our involvement in Vietnam, and that took much longer than he had anticipated. Similarly, Obama criticized the Bush administration for its approach to policy in the Middle East, and then by 2011, finding themselves getting involved in that case in the situation in Libya.
Now, these are presidents from both parties. These are obviously all different situations with different nuances, but is there something about being a president instead of a presidential candidate that makes makes someone say, maybe we do need to be involved in these world affairs?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple things going on there. I think some of it is the information that you have when you're president, and this is information I don't have, obviously, but it seems like that's part of the story, is you obviously have access to much more security information. I think also it's much more difficult to get out of a conflict or to reverse course than it is to promise to reverse course on the campaign trail. And finally, I think that there's a real challenge for presidents of both parties, because the parties have somewhat, as distinct as their ideologies are on domestic issues, there's somewhat less clearly defined ideologies about how to approach foreign policy. So for Democrats, I think it's really telling in 2008, when Obama was running, the Democratic platform talked about intervention in terms of it being multilateral, in terms of it being, in consultation with Congress. It was all about process and not so much a doctrine of, okay, here's when we intervene, here's when we don't. And so Democrats, I think, often find themselves pressured by constituents who are concerned, who have this kind of interventionist spread of democracy idea. Republicans, too, but also by people who have a kind of national security orientation and are concerned in that regard. And then there are people who oppose war also in both coalitions. And so that makes the politics really messy for presidents to navigate.
Talking to Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at President Trump and a lot of former presidents who had messages against intervention, military intervention, and otherwise in foreign countries as candidates, changed their tune upon getting into office. Julia, you bring up in that piece in 538 a counterexample, the Bill Clinton presidency and the genocide in Rwanda. This is something that if you were talking about things from the perspective of American strategic interests, not a place that loomed large in our list, but then President Clinton got a lot of criticism. It was one of his regrets not intervening there.
Right. I think that's really, again, sort of a telling example as far as how presidents face a bit of a double bind. It's worth mentioning that Clinton was also made that decision in the context of what had become a pretty unpopular U.S. intervention in Somalia. And so that was, so that was difficult to sell, and that, there was a lot of upsetting footage with U.S. soldiers in the streets of Mogadishu. I remember that pretty vividly. Really upsetting. And so that kind of shaped how Clinton approached Rwanda, and then the criticism he got for Rwanda approached how he reacted to some of the human rights atrocities that happened in Eastern Europe later on in his presidency. So we kind of see that the pendulum swing with one individual in the Clinton presidency, and really, I think, illustrates that there isn't a clear answer when we're convinced that there are serious security and human rights concerns going on elsewhere in the world. What do we do? What's the right thing to do? I don't know.
Yeah, so how does a president tackle it? I mean, we've got the rhetoric they came in with. We've got the lessons of the previous example, whatever those lessons might be. We've got the pressure maybe from the military insiders, the foreign policy insiders within a government, countervailing messages from the public and Congress. What's a president to do?
Right. I mean, I think that there are a couple of answers here. Some of it, I think, depends on the president's beliefs and values and the way that individual makes decisions. But I also think that it, and this is not a very satisfying answer, but I think it's correct. I think this is how things happen. It also depends on the political calculations and how the public will react to seeing images and hearing stories from certain parts of the world. I think it depends on the strategic considerations in terms of security, and I think, sometimes also economics, commodities that come out of regions in the world. I think all of these, this is a political office, and I think there are ethical and moral considerations that go into those calculations, but I think it's also often a political calculus and a strategic calculus.
Julia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. Been talking about the cases for and against intervention for presidents who often, not just Donald Trump, many presidents, she says, change their tune from the campaign trail to actually taking office in the White House.
According to multiple studies, women are interrupted more often than men. But the question of whether women who hold high degrees of power still get interrupted more often than men was unclear.
Now a new study may be answering that question. Tanya Jacoby and Dylan Schwiers from Northwestern University just completed a study looking at patterns of interruption among the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court over the past 15 years. They found that female Supreme Court justices are interrupted by their male peers three times as often as male justices interrupt one another during oral arguments.
Tanya Jacoby joins us now with a closer look at that study. She's a professor of law at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. Tanya, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's go a little deeper than those first numbers. How often are female justices on the Supreme Court interrupted?
So of all interruptions appearing at the Supreme Court, not counting justices interrupting advocates, which is pretty par for the course, female justices make up about a quarter of the court in the period that we're looking at, from about 2004 onwards, primarily, though we do go back in time. And even though they're only less than a quarter of the people on the court, they get interrupted at about 32%, but they're only responsible for about 4% of the interruptions. So women interrupt a lot less, but they get interrupted at disproportional rates.
And who is it who's interrupting them?
It's both the male justices and the male advocates appearing before them. So even though there's a strict rule saying that the advocates should cease speaking the moment that a justice speaks, and so therefore they shouldn't be interrupting the justices at all, advocates account for about 10% of interruptions on the court, and of those, almost all of them are by men. Women account for 0% of interruptions by advocates.
Now, as the number of women on the Supreme Court goes up and gets closer, it's not there, but as it gets closer to gender parity, what is happening with that rate of interruption?
If anything, the rate is increasing. So rather than the men getting used to having women in a traditionally male domain, the interruptions of women are actually increasing slightly. We've seen interruptions overall on the court increase quite dramatically over time, but the gender pattern has been fairly consistent. But if anything, it's getting slightly worse in the last 4 years.
Right. Some of the figures you came up with are pretty striking. In 2015, you found 65.9% of all interruptions on the court were directed at the three female justices. That's
Ruth
Bader Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan. What do you make of that?
Well, they're only one-third of the justices, so the numbers are pretty clear. I think that what we see is, as you mentioned in the introduction, women are quite used to this. They get interrupted in all sorts of social settings, work settings, whether it's one-on-one conversations or group settings. But we should expect that it shouldn't apply to some of the most powerful women in the world, the Supreme Court justices. But they do, and so there's quite a clear gender pattern. And I think that it both reflects society in terms of women being interrupted generally, but it also means that no matter how powerful a woman becomes, she's still a woman first and is going to get interrupted disproportionately.
Well, and you also looked in particular at Justice Sotomayor, the one woman of color serving on the court. Did you notice anything different with her rate of interruption by other justices and advocates?
We don't have enough sort of racial or ethnic variation on the court to sort of to meaningfully analyze whether that's a factor as well. We certainly do see Justice Sotomayor being interrupted a lot, and anecdotal evidence is that a lot of people talk about Justice Sotomayor as being very talkative, very disruptive, but the numbers don't actually back that up. And I think that perhaps that's driven by a perception because she's Latina, because she's a woman. We see her her behavior that's quite normal, her verbal behavior. It's often interpreted as being pushy or even feisty, which is often a word used to describe Latina women.
And you take a look, you take care at least to point out that you can't ascribe what you're talking about here to Justice Antonin Scalia, who was known for being sort of pugnacious, as you put it. But it's not a Scalia factor here, is it?
No, that's a common view out there that somehow Justice Scalia entered the court and the whole culture of the court changed. But that's actually not supported by the data. What we see is the number of interruptions going up fairly consistently over time. In the time period we look at, we start as far back as 1990. And not only is there not a sudden jump that's associated with Scalia, but Justice Scalia wasn't even the most common interrupter. That title went to Justice Kennedy.
Mm. Well, going back to that power dynamic that you were talking about, and we were wondering if a woman rose to a high rank of power, in this case, a justice on the Supreme Court of the United States, maybe she would not be as interruptible or interrupted as an average woman who's not in that position of power. But then in this case, just gender is still at play. Did that surprise you at all, that there was not a big differential when you got up to the highest court in the land?
It certainly disappointed me. I don't know if it completely surprised me. I mean, it certainly surprised me the rate at which the male advocates interrupted the female justices. Intra-justice interruptions, it's sort of, they're all equal standing, so they all have the same amount of power, but the advocates are formally subordinate to the justices. There are rules about their behavior that the men are consistently breaching. And so that was surprising. And it didn't surprise me when I actually analyzed the data, because I'd listened to so many oral arguments and had just heard these male advocates do this again and again, and really often just talk over the female justices. And these are people they're trying to persuade, people they're trying to win the votes of, and yet they are talking over them, interrupting them, and being quite disrespectful at times.
We're talking with Danya Jacoby right now from Northwestern University School of Law, joining us to talk about her new study that finds female Supreme Court justices are interrupted more often than male justices on the court. And I want to talk to you about an interesting finding here. You looked at the language that was involved and what it might take to not be as vulnerable to interruptions, and the way male justices and female justices employ language. What did you find there?
So linguistic and psychological studies have previously shown that there's something called a female register, that women have a way of speaking that tends to be more polite and less aggressive, more likely to involve questions and statements, for example. And one thing I'd noticed just anecdotally is that I'd heard women say, may I ask, or can I ask, or excuse me, and other like phrases before asking their question. And it's a very polite way to enter the discussion. And I was curious as to whether women would stop saying that as much over time, because they were quite often interrupted at that point because they hadn't got to the substance of their question. And so we looked at trends of using those phrases and a couple of others and found that they decreased quite considerably over time. Now, what we also found is that women come onto the court using that polite language quite a lot, and then gradually they drop down to the level that most men use when entering the court. So there's a sort of equilibrium point at which the men naturally speak with low levels of polite phrasing, and the women gradually learn to be less polite, I think because they're being interrupted so much early on.
So are you essentially saying the women learn to talk like men?
I'm afraid so, yes. That is what we see is women changing their behavior and men not changing their behavior.
And does it seem to work when a woman does do that and does match the tenor of the communication that is dominant with male justices?
It works to some extent, but not a huge amount. So we looked at one way to test whether it actually results in less interruptions is to look at the effect as women are on the court longer. Are they interrupted less? And we find that there is an effect of seniority. More senior justices do interrupt less senior justices, but it's a very, very minor effect compared to gender and also compared to ideology. And so gender is about 30 times as powerful as seniority. So it's not, it helps to change your language, but it doesn't overcome that gender disparity.
Well, there's another aspect of this that we haven't talked about yet. You also found that conservative justices interrupt liberal justices more often. And how did you get a handle on that one, since Supreme Court justices aren't, you know, affiliated with political parties necessarily?
Well, there's different ways of testing judicial ideology. A traditional way used to be just to look at who the appointees were, like whether that was a Republican or Democrat appointee. But there are now quite sophisticated measures of judicial voting behavior, and it's quite standard to see the court in terms of left-right continuum. And so we can use either measure, and either way we find the same thing. But if we look at a sort of a dichotomous variable of ideology or a continuous variable in the extent to which someone is more liberal than someone else, and using both types of measures, we find the same thing, that liberals are interrupted about 2.5 times as often as conservatives. And that's not only justice-to-justice interruptions, but once again, the advocates play a part. The advocates arguing liberal sides before the court interrupt the liberal justices significantly more often than they interrupt the conservative justices.
Whose job is it to enforce the rule of advocates not interrupting?
Well, it's really the Chief Justice's job, and the Chief Justice does occasionally step in, I mean, first and foremost, it's the advocate's job. They should just follow the rules. But if they're breaking the rules, the Chief Justice is sort of in charge of running the proceedings. And he does step in occasionally, but not nearly as often as he could, given the very large number of interruptions by advocates. Occasionally, I've seen him step in and give the floor to the interrupter when it's a justice rather than to the interruptee.
And Tanya, I want to ask you as we get ready to wrap up, why does this matter? I mean, we know that being interrupted is unpleasant, it can be seen as rude, but does it matter as more than a cosmetic aspect of communication when it comes to the Supreme Court of the United States and oral arguments there?
I think it matters both for the court itself and in terms of a sort of social significance. So in terms of the court, oral arguments are the opportunity for the justices to find out information from the advocates, to ask their questions and receive answers, but they're also an opportunity to influence each other. The Supreme Court justices don't talk among themselves very much before they vote, and so oral arguments are a forum for them to sort of ask questions ostensibly of the advocate, but really they're talking to each other. So if women are constantly being interrupted and not able to ask their questions, they're being kept out of both that informational role and that influential role. And I also think it matters socially. If we see that even when you reach the highest pinnacle of a high-status profession such as the law, and you're still being interrupted because you're a woman, then that says something about the extent to which our society has progressed as well.
And Tanya, just a couple seconds left, but any early signs about how Neil Gorsuch as a nominee might look on the court in terms of interrupting?
Well, he certainly was an active speaker yesterday, but I went through the transcripts and did not find him interrupting anyone except the advocates. So on one day of data, so far he has followed behavioral norms, but it's early days, and he's a man and he's conservative, so we shall see how he behaves.
Tanya, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Tanya Jacoby is a professor at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. She joined us to talk about her new study that finds female Supreme Court justices are interrupted more often than male justices. President Trump visited Wisconsin today for the first time since taking office. He chose Snap-on Tools in Kenosha as the location to sign the Buy American, Hire American executive order.
WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach was at the event. He joins us now with the details. Chuck, good to have you back on the show.
Thank you and hello.
Well, set the stage for us. Tell us about the setting, Snap-on Tools in Kenosha.
Right. It's the headquarters of a company founded nearly 100 years ago. I don't think there's much tools being made at this site, but there are several other manufacturing plants in the U.S., including in Milwaukee. So American enough, I guess, for the president's message today of buy American, hire American.
And who is in the audience at the event today?
Well, Republicans from every office level, I think, and as well as business people. The CEO or the president of Snap-on Tools gave a very inspired speech, very praising of Donald Trump of about 5 minutes, and then the president came on, and his style was much shorter than and during the campaign. He only spoke for about 20 minutes in the campaign. He often went for 50 minutes to an hour.
And what was the focus? Did he focus on this Hire American, Buy American executive order in his speaking?
I would say so. He his team had advertised that by leaking something late last night that they was going to sign this executive order, and he followed through with various people on stage, Governor Walker, students from Gateway Technical College who have do some work at Snap-on, and others are on the stage as he signed the executive order. And he talked about it at length during his remarks. As I say, not a hugely long speech, but to the point quite often. In one passage that I think we have, he talked about the part that would require federal agencies, or at least encourage federal agencies, to use more U.S.-made goods in federal construction and transportation projects. The president says there are too many loopholes in the current requirement.
Hey, here's a listen.
But over the years, these Buy American standards have been gutted by excessive waivers and reckless exemptions. The result has been countless jobs and countless contracts that have been lost to cheap, subsidized, and low-quality foreign goods.
So this is, you know, presidents are limited in what they can do directly, but this is one thing the president can do, use the buying power of the federal government, even though he can't necessarily impose those standards on companies. Is he hoping, did he say, hey, private industry, follow this lead here?
Well, no, he didn't quite say that. He's just, right for now, it's sort of a touchy issue how much you can tell the private sector to do things in terms of buy American or use American products and so on. He's trying to, I guess, go help the private sector, these companies that make products here and would like to sell more to the federal government and have them used. Wisconsin Democrats today targeted the president on this Buy American part, releasing an ad saying he hasn't done enough for U.S. workers and that they should get behind, the Republicans should get behind Senator Tammy Baldwin's Buy American legislation that they say the GOP has blocked so far. But here was the president, again, going ahead with the executive order on this part of it.
That's the Buy American side. Then there's the Hire American side, and there he's focusing, it looks like, on reform of H-1N visas, the H-1N visa program. Here's what the president had to say about reforming this guest worker program.
Widespread abuse in our immigration system is allowing American workers of all backgrounds to be replaced by workers brought in from other countries to fill the same job for sometimes less pay. This will stop.
So what did he talk about when it came to reforming this particular kind of guest worker visa?
Well, he said it should be monitored and policed, if you will, more closely and greatly limited. Again, the other is another side here that some technology companies and some other sectors have said, listen, we need these guest workers because they're more skilled than some of the U.S. Workers are, and we need to, you know, make profits and do well. The president says that's gone too far. He claims that, as he says, that there are too many workers waiting to get hired while the guest workers have jobs.
Talking to WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach about President Trump's visit today to Kenosha, focusing on hiring American, buying American products, some changes in the works there, executive order signed by the president. That wasn't; those weren't the only issues he talked about, Chuck. This dairy issue and this tiff with Canada came up. What did the president have to say about that?
Right. Again, this is regarding about 75 Wisconsin dairy farmers who had their milk buyer drop them and are searching for other buyers because the buyer is in a trade dispute with Canada. The president said he's been reading about that, and he actually claims he's been speaking about it for a while. He said that Governor Scott Walker, who was there, and U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, who was there, and House Speaker Paul Ryan of Janesville, who wasn't there because he's on a trade mission, he says they're going to get together and demand answers from Canada and demand a solution. So he's appeared to be right on it, but again, the follow-through, we'll see about that.
And then talked about NAFTA a little, too, segued into that, I think, from the dairy issue.
The good old North American Free Trade Agreement, beloved by many businesses in Wisconsin that have done well under it, but the president, again, sort of echoing what he said during the campaign, he said it's a disaster for the U.S. and promised some big changes ahead. He also talked about a tax plan that's coming and other infrastructure project that's coming group of legislation that's coming on infrastructure. You know, he's getting near his 100 days, first 100 days, wants to say, here's what he's done, here's what he's going to do very soon.
Now, President Trump, when he was on the campaign trail, had issues with members of the Wisconsin Republican community. Governor Walker, of course, was one of his rivals early on. There was the Never Trump movement here in Wisconsin. Did it seem like a lot of Republican Wisconsin dignitaries there, more of a happy Republican family today?
It seemed pretty close ranks. There was no, you know, we heard on the newscast a few minutes ago that Congressman Duffy has raised some concerns about the president's tax returns, but the president was praising Congressman Duffy on the floor of the Snap-on today in the auditorium. So at least outwardly, there is a sign of Republican unity.
And then outside the event, I understand there were protesters, supporters of the president and critics of the president. What was the scene outside the event?
It seemed to be, at least by my count, mainly opponents to President Trump, often focusing on the tax return issue. many of us who haven't filed taxes and have just a few hours yet to go have to abide by the law or face consequences, and they would like to, these protesters would like to see the president be more forthcoming in his tax returns and tell the American people. Some were chanting, "Lock him up," which I guess is a variation of what the Republicans often chanted against Hillary Clinton, "Lock her up," during the campaign.
Now, we've seen some conflict at protests and counter-protests elsewhere in the country, in California and elsewhere. I know a lot of your focus was inside the event itself, Chuck, but was it pretty civil, given the two sides were present outside the event?
From what I could tell on my way in, but there was a strong police presence, Kenosha police, other law enforcement agencies, trying to keep people apart. If there was an incident, I haven't heard about it yet, but it doesn't mean there wasn't. But again, the police were well out in force.
And as far as the president's comments go, we touched on a lot of the high points. Anything we didn't get to that stood out to you?
He talked about trade. He talked about jobs. He talked about taxes. It's really, again, I think he's trying to hold things together amid some poll numbers that aren't particularly favorable, and saying that, look, I'm taking action. I'm taking action for American workers. And that may have a very bipartisan backing to it. I think Senator Baldwin said today on the Buy American part of it that it was a good step forward, that there's more needs to be done. So no one's really going to take a strong argument against helping American workers. It's just whether that follow-up comes as, and the, you know, things like pursuing the visa program and monitoring some of these things actually occurs.
We'll leave it there for now. Chuck, thanks as always for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Kernbach, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. He was at President Trump's event in Kenosha today. He joined us to give us the details. Have you ever tried to tell your friend a serious story and all they want to do is crack jokes? Well, that's kind of the premise behind our next guest's podcast.
Gareth Reynolds joins us now. He got his comedy start in the Milwaukee area and is the co-host of The Dollop, an award-winning podcast that combines comedy with American history. And you can catch it live tomorrow night at Turner Hall in Milwaukee. Gareth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me in Central Time. I can't believe I'm time traveling. Everything I thought it would be.
Well, for people who haven't heard your podcast yet, and there are those out there who have not heard it, can you describe it for us?
Well, first of all, my blood is boiling that not everybody has heard about it. But it's called The Dollop, and it is an American history podcast, but a comedic one. So every week I get together with a buddy of mine who's a comedian, and he will read me a story that he has sort of prepared, like a lesson, if you will, in American history. And I react because I have no idea what the topic is going to be.
And so as far as the not reacting, there's not a whole lot of acting that goes into that. You literally don't know a lot about history, right?
I really don't. We found it's so weird because I think, like, when people start podcasts, you know, they go in with a plan. We just matched up, luckily, with the fact that he loved history and knew a lot of crazy stuff, and that I had just not paid attention at all in school, had never pursued any history knowledge, and therefore, so, you know, he'll say some stuff and he'll look at me and I'll be like, "I've never heard of the consumption," and he's like, "Oh, tuberculosis." Okay, let's keep going.
So what is it like getting this huge data dump of decades and decades of American history?
You know, remember in The Matrix when they just start putting programs into Neo's head and then he just, like, leans up at one point and is just like, "I know Kung Fu." Like, that's what I'm like with history now. I'm like, man, there is, you know, it sounds crazy to be like, man, it's really nuts. But, I've learned a lot and I forget it all very quickly. Like, people will come up and they'll be like, "How about when that dude bought that country?" And I'll be like, "I don't know who you are or what you're talking about."
Yeah. Well, that is part of the fun, though, for the listeners that, you know, some of these stories, they may get old. You know, Lincoln's assassination, we hear that, we know about it, we move on to the next thing. But for you, it's all brand new. So in a way, the listener gets to hear history afresh through somebody else's eyes.
Well, and also a lot of the stuff is, there's definitely stuff that people know, but a lot of this stuff is stuff that nobody has heard of. I mean, there are stories that are just hidden in our history that are just bizarre, crazy, hysterical, tragic, all that. And, you know, I mean, there's just seems like there's an endless amount of crazy things that have happened in America.
Well, for instance, I had no idea that Andrew Jackson was so dual happy. You have an episode about Jackson called the Jackson Cheese, and we've got a clip here. You guys are talking about the number of gun duels that Andrew Jackson participated in. Here's a clip.
Like, when I read this, I was like, okay, he had 103 duels in his lifetime.
That's a lot.
That's everybody.
That's a
that's
lot.
That's like half the people he met.
I mean, really, that's just like, that's every other day dueling. That's like a once a week duel.
No, he's like crazy.
I'd rather duel. Just pay the bar tab, Andrew. I'd rather duel.
I think we're going to, Andrew, please.
No. He looked at me funny. We're dueling.
So there's a taste. Yeah, I had no idea about Andrew Jackson. I'm not a super presidential history buff, but that's interesting. So you also take something that could have been a little dry, and it becomes funny.
Well, and that whole episode is about how he hid cheese. Like, it's crazy. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, yeah. It's a very interesting man, Old Hickory.
So you have absorbed a lot of the history, it sounds like, even though some of it you forget instantly. Do you feel like you are becoming more well-rounded as a historian?
Well, yeah, but I also know me, and I really do know that. I mean, I do retain, but literally on the podcast, there was a time where I just, you know, insinuated, you know, that Ben Franklin was the president, and Dave was just like, Ben Franklin was never president. I was like, get out of here. You know, so I really think that they're, even if I gain knowledge, I'll always be working from behind, unfortunately.
We're talking with Gareth Reynolds right now, co-host of the Dollop podcast. It's about American history. And tell us a little bit how a nice comedian like you ended up talking about history.
Well, you know, I live in Los Angeles, and when I first moved here, podcasts were not even a thing. And so once they started, I just, you know, I would start sort of doing them here and there, and I had landed on a couple, and then I met Dave Anthony, the guy who I co-host it with, and we just sort of clicked very quickly, and, you know, that just, it just, you know, I, honestly, it's, that's one of the things I think with grinding in Los Angeles, you learn, it's like, if people like something, you go towards it, you're like a moth to light. So the second that there was, you know, that people started to enjoy it, I mean, we leaned into it, you know, which brings us on tour, obviously.
How has it changed since you first started it?
The actual podcast?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing, you know, like, date, like at the beginning, you know, we start with a date, so Dave will shout a date. The fact that I have no idea, that I know nothing going in, I mean, those are things that just sort of organically kind of laid out, as well as the fact that now it's the sort of thing where, like, on social media and stuff, obviously there's a lot more interaction and being able to do live shows. I mean, I guess that would be, you know, doing a podcast in a theater is just, you know, 5 years ago, if you had told me if that would have happened, I'd have challenged you to a duel.
So when you're going somewhere, and I know you've been to Australia, you've been kind of all around the world doing this podcast, I know you're the one who's ignorant of the history, but does your partner, Dave, does he have to really bone up on the history of where he's going and do a deep dive there?
His life, if you compare our lives on the road, it's unfair. He will be sitting on a couch with his earbuds in, working on a document, you know, a 10-page document about this whatever he's decided we're going to talk about. And I'll, you know, go find a basketball court or, you know, what, like, so by the time the show arrives, he's like, man, I'm tired. I'm like, let's do this.
There's never a resentment between the two of you that you're the one kind of playing basketball and he's the one.
He resents it.
Working his butt off.
No, he's very clear. He's been very vocal about his resentment for it. But I'll take it. It still means I get to take naps, so.
Is it ever hard for you to stay away from history? Because sometimes, you know, you're in a hotel, you're flipping through channels, and you get sucked into, you know, a documentary about Lincoln or the Civil War. Do you ever feel like you have to turn something off so you can stay pristine and unknowing?
Yes. Thankfully, I really do like documentaries and, you know, more things about our current time and really nature. But there was one time when we were in Australia and I was watching something on, you know, Prohibition or some sort of American era. And Dave walked by me and he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Not be buffing up on the history too much, my man. I was like, oh, sorry. You're right. So there is an avoidance. And it is hard, but it also, you know, again, it's not like I have a sponge for a brain, so we'll be okay.
So this is a comedy podcast. It's funny, but there's real content there about history. Do you think that you're also doing a service? Are you educating people in a sense, even though it's, you know, it's a spoonful of sugar with the medicine?
That's hard to know. It seems like it. It seems like people are affected in ways by this. I mean, I think that there is, there's such a correlation between the world we live in now and the world we, you know, feel like we've left behind. And I think, you know, the podcast probably does a good job, really Dave does a good job of sort of making you draw parallels in a way that I think is valuable, you know, in a way that makes you sort of go, because we no matter what sort of thing you think about right now in our era, whether it's self-driving cars, you know, in 100 years, people might, you know, who knows what's going to happen with self-driving cars, but no matter what, it's probably going to be kind of crazy and funny in a way, you know. So, to some extent, I think, I just don't think I could ever say that I'm helping people learn history knowing so little. Davis.
Well, you're both going to be in Milwaukee, and I wonder if Wisconsin audiences can expect some Wisconsin content. Are we going to hear something about the Badger State?
Yes, I believe so. Dave normally tries to steer it towards the city or the state that that we're in for the show. And as a Milwaukee native, I'm pretty confident I'll still have no idea what it is.
And you got your start in Wisconsin. You did comedy sports. Is there still that Wisconsin boy, those Wisconsin comedy roots? Are they still part of who you are?
Oh, yeah. I'm very proud to be from Wisconsin. You know, I have one tattoo. It's of the Green Bay Packers. I try to keep a strong connection to Wisconsin, try to get back there. My dad still lives there. I have family still there. And, you know, really, my best friend lives there. So I, in my head, I still live in Milwaukee, in my dream scenario.
Good. Well, we're glad to have you as a mental resident of the state.
Thank you. Yes, yes.
Gareth, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much for having me.
Gareth Reynolds is the co-host of The Dollop, a popular American history podcast. And you can catch a live version of The Dollop tomorrow night at Turner Hall in Milwaukee. And Gareth Reynolds will also be doing a bit of stand-up while he's in Wisconsin.